Welcome to Dialogue. I'm George Liston, CA. There are now well over 1,000 books published on various aspects of the presidency of John F. Kennedy and its aftermath. That's a fitting outcome for an administration that began on a high note of glamour and ended in appalling tragedy. But the brutal end of the Kennedy era, the high drama of the assassination probe, and the intricate steps of the presidential transition have remained largely unclear to a public avid for insight into every phase of an extraordinary national trauma. Most tellingly, the thoughts, sentiments, and actions of the man at the epicenter of that crucial chapter, Lyndon Baines Johnson, have not hitherto been rendered with sufficient clarity. In the Kennedy assassination tapes by Max Holland, we have Johnson's own voice, his conversations from the days, weeks, and years following the day in Dallas that altered his fate and a nation's destiny. My guest is Max Holland, author of the Kennedy assassination tapes, the White House conversations of Lyndon Baines Johnson regarding the assassination, the Warren Commission, and the aftermath, published by Knopf. Max, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you, George.
Max, is an extraordinary book. I might as well say that right now. And let's examine why that's so. These are the actual conversations, and I think that's worth some emphasis right at the start. You listened to Lyndon Johnson's voice, not just from covering the day of Dallas and the few weeks after that, but over the next several years of his presidency. I found it very compelling, but it leads to two opening questions to you. First, Max, as an historian and author, what are the rules of the road for what you did? I mean, how did you do it? And related to that, even in the briefest statement, what's the kind of special contribution that this sort of book makes?
Those are two good questions. This is sort of a new genre, I think, because of we never had presidential recordings really as a body of work before. So in a way, this is like an old genre, the collected papers of Thomas Jefferson or Woodrow Wilson, but it's much more gripping because you actually have the voices from the past.
Right.
As Johnson put it, history with the bark off. This is what really happened before it was rinsed for public consumption or whitewashed or prettied up. And so it makes for a very, very compelling account because it is what happened on the one hand, and it's interesting because it shows the presidency of Johnson shadowed by the assassination in a way we haven't really understood.
Absolutely. I mean, I was struck by that, and I think that's an excellent answer on your part, Max. I was struck by this new dimension of what Johnson underwent. In fact, that's my very next question. If you were to characterize what kind of story we are told here, but let me risk my notion and see if what you think of it. I saw it on two levels. One is the political machinations, the calculations, the strategies that Johnson as a president was dealing with related to the Kennedy assassination and what he wanted to do as president. But on a second level, it's an extraordinary story of pathos and what he was challenged with as a president on a personal level. But what's your sense?
No, that's absolutely correct. What's happened is because of all the controversy over the whodunit, we've not looked at the assassination as a historic event. Mm-hmm. It's always mired in this question whether there was a conspiracy or not. But once you get past that and put that to rest, and it's obviously an important question who did it, but once you get past that question, you can begin to integrate the assassination into the history of the times, and that allows you to have several insights, the most important of which, let's say, why Johnson left the race in 1968, which I think is answered by his whole feeling about how he'd come into office and how he was mistreated by the liberal wing, although he felt he had done more to advance that faction's goals than anyone could expect on November 22nd.
This is precisely true. That's worth underlining, that I got a sense of the assassination and the aftermath, not just as an event, but as an ongoing drama and theme throughout his presidency that did lead to a decision taken in 1968. And bearing in mind, as the book points out, because there's a lot of commentary and analysis that goes together with the recorded conversations here, We had the Civil War, or Civil Rights, rather, disputes going on. We had certainly had Vietnam. But this was an issue of a dominant issue in Johnson's thinking.
It was very dominant. He felt that, and the other thing about it is that he is just like the rest of us. I mean, we think of him as the president, of course, but in a way, he's just like every American at the time. He had his own pet theories about what had happened. They changed over time. Ultimately, he believed there was a conspiracy directed from Cuba because he knew what we only found out as a people 8 years later, which was that the U.S. government had tried to kill Castro in the early 1960s. Therefore, he felt that the assassination was retaliation for that effort, and no amount of persuasion and could change his mind. He went to his death thinking that, and it was a very heavy secret for him to bear.
Right. Didn't he, in fact, Max, kind of have that as a beginning and ending conclusion? In other words, he made a comment early in the entire episode about divine retribution.
Right, but that
and
was
the sense of Diem's killing by the Kennedys.
Right, he knew that the United States was heavily responsible for Diem's murder because we had helped bring about his overthrow. Now, he wasn't supposed to be killed, quote-unquote. He was supposed to be forced into exile. But Johnson knew we had a heavy role in this. And, of course, at the time, if you remember back then, Madame New, which was Diem's sister-in-law, went around the country blaming the United States.
Right.
And she was ridiculed and dismissed and dissed for suggesting such a thing. Cause, you know, that was a much more naive time before Vietnam about what U.S. United States sometimes tried to do abroad.
Two of the major themes get established right at the start, day one, the day of the assassination itself. The first, and this is almost Shakespearean in its drama and its telling effect over time, Robert Kennedy never liked Lyndon Johnson, I don't think.
It was the worst imaginable situation. Not only didn't they like each other, but here was a person who evoked memories of John F. Kennedy.
Exactly.
Who had been, in essence, the vice president in reality during the Kennedy administration.
And Bobby didn't want him on that ticket.
Right, and Bobby wanted to force Johnson off. So it was the worst possible situation that Johnson had to contend with him. There's one conversation there he has with Katzenbeck that I think sums it up. Johnson says, I'm not trying to stay in Bobby's way. He can be president. Just let me be president first.
That is, I mean, that's what I mean by pathos. Like almost the agony that you sense that Johnson felt. I mean, I quite frankly felt very sympathetic to Lyndon Johnson at many points in this, because right from day one throughout, and this is another question, Max, it seems to me he has two challenges. He has to exhibit appropriate reverence given this extraordinary event, but he also has to assume the levers of power as a president. I mean, it's
right.
That's an incredible.
And Robert Kennedy, you know, was very grudging in that respect. He didn't want Johnson to give a speech right away to the nation. He had him delay the session he made before joint session of Congress. He didn't want him to move into the Oval Office on Saturday. You know, this was the height of the Cold War. His national security advisors were saying, you have to show that you have all the instruments of the presidency at your disposal to exhibit continuity. And Robert Kennedy asked him not to move into the Oval Office. I mean, who would dare say that to a president?
That speaks volumes right there. Who would dare say that to a president? In fact, the very first moments of the Johnson presidency are embroiled in a controversy in Bobby's mind and the mind of others that's going to replay itself throughout and get reflected in the book that William Manchester will write, and we'll come to that in a moment. But I'm referring to the very question of the oath-taking aboard the plane. That seems to be
a false issue if there ever was one. Johnson had taken the oath in 1961.
He didn't have to take any oath, though, really.
It was completely ceremonial.
Right.
He didn't have to take the oath. He was president already. But in the panic and the consternation of the moment, no one remembered that. They thought he should take the oath before he takes off. So he called up Bobby Omis asking his permission or agreement, which he didn't need to, but he did. And so then it becomes a big issue because Robert Kennedy objects to the depiction of him as encouraging Lyndon to do it before he left Dallas, rather than waiting until he came back to Washington.
This is so extraordinary because this one thing, which I think you, again, very, very well described, will plague Johnson for years. I mean, this...
When you listen to the conversation he has with Bill Moyers and others about the Manchester book in late 1966. It pains your heart. I didn't realize what an existential threat the Manchester book. It was the ultimate insult to a politician. Johnson had played by the rules. He had sublimated his own ambitions and agreed to be vice president, although he never ceased to want to be president. Mm-hmm. And here he was thrust into office, and he's being depicted in a way. I mean, today it's not that unusual, but mm-hmm. in the early 60s, a major New York publisher like Harper and Row did not publish books that depicted sitting presidents in the manner Johnson was depicted. It was unheard of, mm-hmm. you know, grasping for power, thrusting Mrs. Kennedy into that famous picture aboard Air Force One, you know, ordering Evelyn Lincoln, President Kennedy's secretary out of the Oval Office. Mm-hmm. And they were untrue to boot.
He was grievously hurt. And let's spend a moment on this now. I was going to come back to this later, but let's stay on it right now. Because to me, quite frankly, in all the conversations, they're all fascinating and gripping. This was the most powerful chapter to me, because we're talking about William Manchester's book, Death of a President, which the Kennedys essentially commissioned and then tried to stop because they didn't like the tone of it. And it depicts Johnson in this way that you've just described, and it's terribly unfair. The amount of conversation he devotes to this, the number of calls and the anguish in those calls, Max, at a time when everything domestically and internationally was going very critical, is striking.
Right. I mean, these were 45-minute, 50-minute calls with Abe Fortas and Bill Moyers. Mm-hmm. And at one point, I can still hear it, Johnson saying he's been accused in the book of calling Mrs. Kennedy honey, using that term of endearment. Mm-hmm. He says, I don't remember ever calling her honey, and if I did, so what?
It's a Texas thing.
Right. And then there's this whole false story of the Bible, this supposed Bible that was used to give him the oath of office. And in Manchester's book, it's the personal Bible of President Kennedy given him, well-thumbed, you know, well-worn. Well, the thing was a Catholic missal, had never been, it creaked when you opened it. And it wasn't stolen, as alleged by Manchester. Right. It was a keep. Mrs. Johnson had kept it as a keepsake, a treasured keepsake of that terrible moment.
Yeah. Let me take a moment from our conversation, Max, just to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest is Max Holland, author of The Kennedy Assassination Tapes. This book focuses, as the subtitle indicates, a lot of its attention on the Warren Commission. And I'd like to turn to that right now, because one of the essential things here that I did not know before reading this, and now have in Johnson's own words, thanks to you, he didn't even want a commission.
He didn't want it at all. He consulted with Abe Fortas, who was a very powerful Washington lawyer at the time, later Supreme Court Justice. Fortas cautioned him, do not bring an investigation of your predecessor's murder into the White House whatsoever. Mm-hmm. You are not to have anything to do with it. And that's advice Johnson initially tried to follow. Leave it with the FBI, which will make a report to the Attorney General, mm-hmm. and have Texas state procedures go on as necessary.
What changes his mind?
Two things. Basically, Capitol Hill starts to get involved. You have mm-hmm. the Senate Internal Security Committee, mm-hmm. which is headed by Jim Eastland, mm-hmm. who's anti-communist, which is okay by Johnson, but Eastland sees communists everywhere.
Everywhere, right. Mm-hmm.
And he's worried that Eastland will blame or seek to blame the assassination on Oswald's affinities for the Soviet Union and or Cuba. Mm-hmm. The House Un-American Activities also announces an investigation because of Oswald's membership in the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. Mm-hmm. Of course, the House Judiciary Committee is going to get involved too, mm-hmm. and they're headed by liberals, and those guys are probably going to try and find a right-wing conspiracy. And in 1964 being an election year, they're all going to be, you know, grabbing for the headlines, trying to outdo each other.
Right.
And there are a lot of very sensitive secrets mm-hmm. involved, especially in Oswald's trip to Mexico City, where he was caught on surveillance by the CIA, mm-hmm. which works on surveilling communist bloc embassies in conjunction with Mexican authorities.
Right.
Now, if that comes out, all hell will break loose because, you know, it's a very sensitive issue for the Mexicans.
So President Johnson, to get out in front of all of that and to keep much of that from happening and to get at least perhaps some degree of controllability over it, finds the commission attractive. But when he does, Max, he doesn't anticipate the commission doing what it does or being what it is. That is, in a sense, my notion was when he accepts the idea, he feels that he's going to look at the FBI report.
Yeah.
And kind of pass on it in a couple of weeks.
He tells Russell and Warren and the others, you're just going to spend 2 or 3 months reading over the FBI report and make sure all the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it doesn't happen that way. These commissions tend to take on a life of their own,
mm-hmm.
and that's what happened in this case. They found the FBI investigation wanting, and essentially they reinvestigated the assassination.
Right. As he puts this commission together, this gives you and I an opportunity, for me actually, an opportunity to ask you to characterize some of the phone calls he's making with people that he'll be has been talking to before and will continue to talk to over the years, really. But I found them, among so many others, especially fascinating because of who they were and what they represented to him, beginning with J. Edgar Hoover, who comes across here as a figure of enormous personal power, to use the cliche, often wrong but never in doubt, and a man who can intimidate people all the way up to the level even of Johnson. He tended to be a little deferential around him.
Right. He hadn't been in office long enough to know that whatever his wish was Hoover's command, because
mm-hmm.
he was used to being a supplicant to Hoover like everybody else in Washington. There was only one person at a time who wasn't a supplicant, and that was the man who happened to be president.
Right.
Johnson was still learning that.
Mm-hmm.
What's also amazing about the Hoover conversations, though, is the sheer amount of bad information
right.
he conveys to Johnson in the conversations they have.
Mm-hmm.
The trouble with Hoover is he feels he has to be omniscient. Rather than saying, when asked a question, "I don't know, Mr. President, I will mm-hmm. find out and let you know the answer," he just says things off the top of his head because I could not find them in the contemporaneous FBI reports.
Mm-hmm.
And he just gives Johnson a lot of bad information. It's astonishing that the FBI director would do that.
It does provoke a reader to think about that degree of unquestioned power in the hands of any individual in the American government. I mean, it's probably, I hope it's a story that doesn't repeat itself, but it really is a cautionary tale.
I think it's part, you know, he was just in office too long.
Yeah. Abe Fortas is an entirely different way, a different set of conversations. And even a Supreme Court justice, before that fact and during that fact, he plays a role as Johnson's counselor. There's a very close, a high degree of confidence that Johnson places in his judgment.
Right. Some of the most candid conversations, especially about who he wants on the Warren Commission, are with Fortas.
Mm-hmm.
And, for example, he tells Fortas, "Well, I'm going to put Richard Russell on, the senator from Georgia, so I can keep Eastland off," because protocol would call for the chairman of the Senate mm-hmm. Judiciary Committee to be on it. But Johnson doesn't trust Eastland's judgment, and with mm-hmm. good reason. And so that conversation, showing Johnson's estimates of people and their integrity and their judgment, is very illuminating.
Yeah. It's worth mentioning also that Richard Russell has a special place in Johnson's universe.
Absolutely. Richard mm-hmm. Russell, you know,
Senator
wanted
from Georgia.
To be the first Southerner to be president, mm-hmm. that he wanted to eliminate that vestige of the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
And in 52, which was the only time he tried, he was beaten back very swiftly by the liberal wing, it said, because of his stance on civil rights, he could never hope to get the nomination. So in Johnson, he sees the man, the son he never had, to fulfill that ambition.
You get that sense. It's a kind of a filial reverence from Johnson to Russell.
And in the conversations with Russell, you know, this is something you can't really get from just reading a transcript. Russell's one of the few people Johnson actually listens to.
Yes.
When he says something.
Well said. Another entirely different category and set of conversations are those which involve Jacqueline Kennedy. And here I was struck by something, and I'd love to get your comment with even a kind of a psychological analysis aspect to it. And that is, he genuinely, I thought, revered Jackie Kennedy. I mean, you get a sense that he is really holds her in the highest possible esteem. And he tries to convey that, but sometimes it's a bit rough-hewn. I mean, it's just his style of doing it. But his feelings are quite sincere.
Right. He put her up on a pedestal that night, November 22.
Mm-hmm.
As he went to bed, he couldn't stop talking about her behavior that day mm-hmm. and how when the nation seemed to be coming. And this is even before the funeral, remember, when mm-hmm. she also displayed this stoicism just bowled over the whole nation.
Right.
I mean, for those 4 days, she seemed to be holding the country mm-hmm. together, not him.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just marveling about her behavior. And ever after that, he always held her up on a pedestal. Now, a lot of it was, or some of it was obviously calculated. He wanted to bask in the mm-hmm. tremendous esteem with which she was held. But it was genuine. His feelings for her were genuine for what she had accomplished.
Right. Let's discuss in sort of quick succession, Max, 3 years, 64, 65, 60, almost 64, 65, 66, 67, as the story progresses. First of all, when Lyndon Johnson wins his much-desired presidency in his own right in 1964 with a landslide, and, of course, he's got a lot to contend with. Getting elected was his major challenge. Continuing to manage the feud with Bobby Kennedy is an ongoing issue. The Warren Commission comes out in 64. Now, that's a plus for him, isn't it?
It is a plus at first. For the first, you know, the Warren Commission report, when it was published in September 64, was widely hailed. The whole thing was published in the New York Times. It was universally regarded as a definitive document, what a commission dedicated to the truth could accomplish. And that honeymoon lasts for about 2 years.
Right, yeah. But when the doubts start, they begin to kind of spiral, don't they?
They do. And in one of the conversations I was very fortunate to include, because it was only released last April, a conversation between Johnson and Fortas. When I heard this, I thought I had heard everything. But when I heard this, I was bowled over, because Johnson actually blames Robert Kennedy for fomenting distrust and disbelief in the Warren Report, not understanding that Robert Kennedy is the last person in the world who wants to raise questions about this. That's the degree to which Johnson had by then become paranoid about Robert Kennedy's machinations against him.
I think paranoid is absolutely the correct word to use. I mean, you're just struck by that. One reading is struck by that. By 1966, though, things are turning against him, not just because the commission report is being subject to doubt. Now we have this extraordinary episode of the Manchester book.
The Manchester book and the criticism of the Warren Report.
Right.
And confidence in the Warren Report plummets because the Saturday Evening Post, Life, call for need to have reinvestigations because there are all these unanswered questions. And then the other shoe drops in early 1967. This district attorney in New Orleans announces a reinvestigation of the assassination.
Yeah, and let's focus on this. This is Jim Garrison.
Right.
And I actually remember this when it happened and the kind of bombshell effect it seemed to immediately happen. But it's an outrageous charge. He actually charges. And here, there's an aspect of this, Max, I think only this book revealed. If I got it correctly, Garrison's going so far as to implicate Johnson.
Right.
And the conspiracy that killed Kennedy.
Right.
But Johnson's reaction was perhaps not entirely passive, but he seemed to say it was just one more thing he was being hit with. In other words, he didn't boil over at it.
Right, he didn't boil over. First of all, he knew it was untrue, so whatever Garrison thought he had or where he was going wasn't going to lead anywhere. And at the same time, Johnson had heard this rumor from Drew Pearson, who was a muckraking columnist, that there had been attempts to assassinate Castro. So I think, and this is my interpretation, I think Johnson felt that if Garrison thought there was more to what was going on than had been reported, that he was probably tugging at the end of this other story about these assassination efforts against Castro, which Johnson also had nothing to do with. So Johnson is completely nonplussed by Garrison. And then within a couple of weeks, he's told that he's a fraud, that the whole thing, you know, his arrest of Clay Shaw, a prominent businessman, there's no basis for it. You know, it's akin to arresting Robert Moses if you were in New York. It's just, it's absurd.
It's other, but you know, here's this question, Max. The image that comes into your mind as you read this is of Saint Sebastian with all the arrows sticking in him, and you begin to think, at least I did at that point in the book, well, maybe it's just too much at this point. That Johnson has been beleaguered. This is something he can't. You know, everywhere he turns, it's bedeviling him. Other things are going badly, obviously. I mean, there's riots in the cities, and Vietnam is souring.
I mean, the country has undergone a remarkable transformation from 64 to 67, just in those 3 years.
So how do you see him reflected in these conversations in terms of his thinking towards, this is it, I'm not going to go
Well, I think he still wants to be president very much, and he intends to run. And even in 1967, when he learns the truth from the CIA about attempts to overthrow Castro, he says not a word about it, although it would be devastating to his predecessor, the reputation of his predecessor, and by extension, Robert Kennedy's reputation, if the truth came out. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it comes out in a Drew Pearson column, but mm-hmm. nobody believes it because everyone is sort of like Johnson was when he first heard it. You know, it's like someone coming up and telling him Lady Bird was a dope addict. You know, he just finds it completely unbelievable.
Yeah. But, you know, there's another, though, instance where, and I said earlier, I do feel a great deal of sympathy for Lyndon Johnson, when he could have done something political and quite vindictive for the Kennedys and chose not to.
Right.
Among other, he had other opportunities too, but this one as well.
Oh, there was the Dominican Republic intervention. Mm-hmm. He found a memo in which President Kennedy asked Robert McNamara how long it'd take to get 27,000 Marines in the Dominican Republic or any other Caribbean country.
Right.
So there are a lot of things that he desists from because he feels a bargain was made in 1960. And if there's one thing Johnson believes in, it's loyalty.
And in that answer, Max, actually gives us a wonderful platform for the concluding question I have, which is because of that and that kind of sense of Lyndon Johnson and his motivations, what kind of man for you emerges from these pages in ways that might have surprised or perhaps even confirmed what you thought? In other words, my notion of him was that while he was a wheeler dealer in many ways and certainly held to be one, there was a nobility about him at the core that I found remarkable throughout this book. But I'm more interested in your sense of what's revealed about Lyndon Johnson in this way that we didn't know before.
Well, I think there has to be a reevaluation of Johnson, and I think it's particularly relevant because the Democratic Party almost still disowns him or distances itself. The one president who wasn't mentioned at the recent Democratic convention, really, was Johnson.
He's not even welcome at conventions after
right.
the presidency.
He was never welcome after 1968 ever again. And he did more during his presidency to make this country. I mean, just think of the Immigration Act, I think, of 1965. Mm-hmm. It's completely changed the demography, the complexion of this country in our lifetimes.
This is true.
That was Johnson's doing, not to mention Medicare and civil rights. And he gave the Democrats a difficult legacy, you know, because of the divisive war. But I think he has to be reevaluated and looked at, you know, gotten out from under this Kennedy aura, which mm-hmm. still overshadows him.
I think this book is a fine contribution toward that very end. Max Holland, thank you so much.
Thank you, George.
My pleasure. You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Max Holland, author of The Kennedy Assassination Tapes. I'm George Liston CA, producer and host of Dialogue. Our technical director is John Tyler. Our production engineer is Anthony Barber. Our assistant producer is Sharana Ward. And our production assistant is Sarah Armstrong. Dialogue is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.